Thank you very much for those readings. Before I begin, I have something of a confession to make, or perhaps it's a spoiler alert. For those of you who've been following the theme, and particularly the titles, and perhaps doing following that in your home groups, you might be expecting Praying Our Intimidation to be the title of tonight's talk. Well, quite apart from the fact that it's grammatically clumsy and arguably incoherent, as I was praying and meditating on the passage, that wasn't what was coming through. So tonight, we're going to be thinking about, where's our vision? Where's your vision? And Psalm 2 is quite a well-known psalm. It might be familiar to you from the words of Handel's magnificent musical masterpiece, The Messiah. One of the songs is, "Why do the nations so furiously rage together? Why do the people imagine a vain thing? The kings of the earth rise up, and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed." It's a timeless psalm, and it applies to us as much today as it did when it was first written. Now, you might be reading it right now, and I encourage you to keep it open. Well done to those of you who have. But you might be looking at this right now and thinking, it's a royal psalm set in 10th century Israel. How can it apply to us today? Well, all will be revealed in due course. The psalm starts by posing a question. Why do the nations rise up against God? It's also a statement of fact. Rulers conspire. People conspire. Israel is surrounded by warring nations. The very existence of the nation is at threat. And this is the context and environment of kingship. The psalm lays out the realities of life in the 10th century BC and the realities of life today. Peoples and nations conspire. They go against God's reign and rule. Now, if you think I'm overstating it, just read the papers, watch the news, look around you. Is this a world in harmony? A world motivated by love for God and love for neighbour? We might be more technically and industrially advanced than at any other time in history, but we've also caused more wanton destruction to God's earth. Yeah, we've had some fantastic inventions, the fridge freezer, the microwave oven, the machine gun, and the atom bomb. The world is an unstable place, and that's reflected in individual lives as much as in leadership. And if people are not following God, they follow some other path, some other motivation, which can take them in various directions. I'm not going to say that all paths are bad, but I will say that none are holy except one. But it's true that in amongst all the multiplicity of choices about how we live our lives, what we do, what we value, there's a great deal of evil, wickedness, pain, corruption, and rebellion. There was 3,000 years ago when this psalm was written, and there is still today. Because as the writer of Ecclesiastes said, there's nothing new under the sun. Other paths, other motivations. In the Old Testament, it was called idolatry. We don't tend to use that word very much today, certainly not in that context. But ambition, motivation, lifestyle choice, call it what you like. It's the thing that motivates you, that inspires you. It's the thing that you live for. It's the thing that shapes you. It's whatever ultimately drives us. whether that's money, status, having a nice house and a big car, our possessions, or fame, or even just to be happy. What's your vision? What's your focus? Do you, like me, sometimes cringe a bit at the reality TV programs? The way that people's lives seem to be directed towards televised fame. Even just a few minutes of it. And on the one hand, it seems cruel to laugh at someone's dream. But on the other, there's almost an absurdity about it. That a person's whole identity is really wrapped up in being behind a microphone. Being a face and a voice on television. Being the person that others want to be. Now, I'm not saying that singing is inherently wrong in itself. But when it's all that we're about, when our whole identity is wrapped up in that, then there's something gone a bit wrong. Is there not more to life than that? And yet, on the other hand, the challenge turns to us, even to me. Is that how I am with my career, with my decisions, even with serving God? Do I do it because I want the status, the identity here and now, to be up on the stage behind the microphone? Or because I'm serving the eternal God with an eternal message of eternal hope, serving God with all my heart and mind and soul and strength, and allowing Him to change me and even my motives? Now, I'd like you to just think for a moment and imagine a new type of reality TV show. It's a reality TV show to help choose pastors, ministers, vicars. What shall we call it? Pope Idol. Yeah, that's not bad. Yeah, we could call it Pope Idol. Or maybe Voice of the Pastor. Or how about Priest Factor? Now, I'd like you to imagine that out here we've got a panel of four. We've got Simon Cowley, because it's always him, isn't it? And next to him we've got the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby. We've also got the moderator of the General Assembly of the Church of Scotland, Angus Morrison. And then we've got Pope Francis. It's a very ecumenical panel. And here I am up on stage. Simon turns to me and says, "Who are you? And tell us why you're here." "Well, Simon, my name's Will. And I'm here because I want to be a vicar. In fact, you know, I've always wanted to be a vicar. When I was growing up, I used to recite the Book of Common Prayer in the shower every morning. And I'd go to school and I'd preach to all my friends." Funny, I don't have any friends now. But and I'd go down to the pub and I'd do gigs and Bible studies and stuff. I just want to be a vicar. "Great, Will. Well, show us what you can do. You've got a couple of minutes." Now, I'm not sure if I would get four yeses. But the problem with this, with all of this, is it's ultimately all about me. And it's an attitude immortalized in the song by Frank Sinatra that so many love. "I did it my way." Now, I have to admit, I cringe at the way it's sometimes used as an anthem for "I did it my way." Because that's the problem. "I did it my way. We did it our way." And look at the state of the world. It's also the story of the Bible. We were made in the image of God, originally in close relationship with God. But we chose to do it our way, didn't we? Not His way. And the result
Nations conspire, peoples plot. They rebel against God and mock God. In its time, this psalm was a reminder of the state of the world and a proclamation both to the Israelite king and to other rulers to submit to God. Now, it's thought that it was probably a coronation psalm, perhaps used in the coronation of David, maybe his successors. Or it could even have been used in an annual reenactment of the coronation, a kind of rededication to remind the king who he serves. And it's an amazing psalm. It's an incredible psalm for several reasons, and I'd like to share a few of those with you, a few of the things I've learned as I've been meditating on this over the last few days, because I think it might actually blow your mind. Now, there are four sections to the psalm, and slightly small there, but hopefully you can just about see it. But the psalm breaks up into four parts. Now, in verses 1 to 3, it tells us about the leaders who rebel against God. And then in the second part, you've got verses 4 to 6. That rebellion is almost laughable in the face of God the Almighty, the creator of the universe, the one beyond time. A leader of a nation, small or large, is still one human being. And yes, they can inflict destruction and even suffering on people, but they're no threat to the Almighty. No threat to the one who's appointed his king in Zion. Then the third part, God's leader, the anointed one, proclaims God as ruler over all and promises to make the nations God's inheritance. And then finally, the fourth part, the leaders are warned to submit to God, serve God with fear and reverence. Now, this flows as a whole, but the first and the last part flow together quite naturally. The leaders rebel. Don't rebel, submit to God. If you rebel, that's the way to destruction. And then the second and third part, they also flow together. God has appointed his king in Zion. And his anointed one points to God. Now, if you really want to know, this is called a chiasm, and it's a type of structure that's sometimes used in ancient writings. But the point is that the author is looking to eternity. It's about God's way, not our way. Where's your vision? Now, the really interesting bit comes next, because the psalm is incredible in its remit. In its time, it was about the Davidic king. Quite possibly David himself. But you can actually put this psalm in four different times, eons, well, kind of three, but four. Well, actually, let me explain. Firstly, it's set in its historic context, the 10th century BC. David is king. Israel is surrounded by enemies. War and the threat of war are a regular feature of life. David has been quite successful, but war is all around. In this context, David can be seen as the one installed on Zion. And the psalm could well be viewed in the light of David's successes. Now, it's probably worth saying a few words about Zion here, because it's a term that can sometimes appear vague and ambiguous. And for years, I wondered what it meant in different readings. Zion was originally a Jebusite fortress in the southeast corner of Jerusalem. And later, it was used as a name for the location of the temple. Sometimes it was also used as a name for Jerusalem, and even occasionally for the nation Israel. It was also used for the dwelling place of God, or for the hereafter, in which case it becomes more of a spiritual, eternal reference rather than a physical location. Now, in this historic reading of the psalm, Zion is the Temple Mount. So it's a coronation psalm. a psalm of praise to God by a ruler enthroned in Jerusalem, and a reminder that God is sovereign over all.
That's the first setting of it. But it gets better, because while it was written in a particular time and in a particular style, which may not always sit easy with us, because we think and write in a different kind of style, yet within it, and while the writer knew it or not, there's a prophetic dimension. I actually suspect that the writer didn't know it, otherwise it'd be more explicit. So just imagine, the writer is writing this, not realizing that actually what they're writing has this massive prophetic dimension which is unfolded for us today. There's a prophecy of a future time when God's Son is on the throne. And in this reading, the Anointed One is the Messiah, Jesus, enthroned in Zion in eternity, the dwelling place of God. Jesus, who Matthew reminds us, is of the royal line of David. And Jesus affirmed on many occasions that he was the Anointed One, the Messiah. To the woman at the well, to Peter, and so on. You might remember that Jesus asked the disciples, "Who do people say that I am?" And they replied, "Well, some say Moses, or Elijah, or one of the prophets." "But who do you say that I am?" And Peter replied, "You're the Christ, the Son of the living God." Jesus said, "Yeah, well done. Flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who's in heaven." Jesus affirmed that he was the Messiah. But many people thought that he was an earthly ruler. He was going to rebel and overthrow the Romans. And we might well have done in their shoes too, in their context. So Jesus also reminded his hearers on many occasions, such as in John 18:36, that his kingdom is not of this world. The Zion he is ruler of is not of this world. And despite that, one of the charges against Jesus is that he is the King of the Jews. He intends to set himself up as king. And when he was crucified, Pilate put the inscription over him, "This is the King of the Jews." Jesus is the king spoken of in verse 6, in Psalm 2, verse 6. A king set up by God, but not an earthly ruler, instead the ruler of God's kingdom, a kingdom not of this world. And what does Jesus commission his followers to do? To go out to all the nations and make disciples, to make the world an inheritance. The Bible also reminds us in many places that there's an ultimate accountability to God, the Creator who's above all and beyond all. Now let's not be tempted to dumb down our view of God into something like an innocuous old grandfather figure, surrounded by Victorian cherubs floating on clouds playing their harps. That's an image, a caricature, a cartoon, and it's not worthy of worship. There are people who really have that view of God, and no wonder they don't worship God. Sometimes we too easily lose the sense of holiness, otherness, beyondness, of what it will be to be in the majestic, awesome, magnificent presence of God. It'll be wonderful, but also fearful. Especially so for those who do not submit to God, because there is a reckoning. One of the contrasts in this psalm is between those who live for now and those who live for eternity. That brings us back to what drives us. What motivates us? What do we live for? Are the things we live for now or for eternity? Where's your vision? Yes, we have to make day-to-day decisions, but are we ultimately living for God's purposes, which have an impact here and now, or just for ourselves here now? Do we have an eternal perspective, or is it all about me now? You see, living for God is not just the cliched pie in the sky when you die. Our choice is to only live for us, ourselves, now, or to live for God, for His kingdom, for His eternity, which also affects and even changes now. An eternity that inspired the first disciples to go out. 11 out of 12 of them were martyred. An eternity that inspired Paul. An eternity that inspired St. Francis. An eternity that inspired William Carey, the founder of the Church Missionary Society. An eternity that inspired Hudson Taylor. An eternity that inspired Eric Liddell. An eternity that inspired Jackie Pullinger. What inspires you? Where's your vision? Where's our vision? By now, hopefully you've got it. This psalm is applicable to us today, to our world, to our leaders, and to us. Who do we follow? What do we live for? Do we choose to submit to God, the eternal, the creator, the redeemer, the one who invites us into His family, His kingdom, His reign, the one who invites us into His rule, His forgiveness, His restoration? Or do we want to continue doing things our way, on a path that leads to destruction? What can we do to further the cause of God's kingdom? Well, if you want a quick reminder, then some of the key principles of God's kingdom, then do turn to Luke chapter 4, verses 16 to 19. Jesus in the synagogue at Nazareth, proclaiming His mission. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because He's anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He sent me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners and recovery of sight for the blind, to set the oppressed free, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favour. What does that mean for us? What does that mean for you, for me? For how we respond to the poor, the homeless, the prisoners, the refugees? What does that mean for how we vote? How we lobby our representatives, including MPs? What does that mean for how we relate to our neighbours, our work colleagues, even those who oppose and conspire against us? Where's your vision? Where's our focus? What does that mean for the decisions we make today and tomorrow? Are they decisions for today and tomorrow only? Or do we have an eternal perspective? Amen.